And, oh, where's the Gene Shepherd tape? Not in the machine. Here it is. Okay, Gene Shepherd from 1962. These are shows that I was given on the promise that I would not sell, barter, or in any way hand them off to people, but broadcasting was permitted from this fellow out in Washington, so let's broadcast them and get them out there somehow to hear. From February the 15th, 1962, complete with the jumble of news and strangeness at the beginning. Here's Gene.
The situation could develop into another Korea. Mr. Kennedy confirmed an earlier statement by British leader Macmillan that there will be no nuclear testing on Christmas Isle in the Pacific, at least until the opening of the Geneva conference next.
You know, I'm constantly being torn between those terrible poles. It's like, it's like an attempt to see through something that is unseeable throughable. You know, it's like you're swimming in a 4,000-foot deep sea of Lipton's pea soup, and you keep getting hit by onions. Bouncing around that, once in a while, a little piece of chicory comes past, and occasionally a little itsy bitsy piece of maybe carrot. I mean, to give it a little pizzazz. It's a kind of get a little boop there. You know, speaking of the little boop there, very difficult to know which pathway you're taking. Now, before we go any further, I would, I suppose, feel duty bound to say that the following program does not represent the viewpoint of Lester Smith, or John A. Gambling, or John B. Gambling, or John L. Gambling, or John D. Gambling the Fourth, who will be on next year. It doesn't represent anybody's viewpoint, actually, except my own. I feel duty-bound also to say this, in all fairness, that if you're not interested in a personal viewpoint, you better leave. I don't want any unpleasantness here. Unpleasantness. Yet, on the other hand, what would we do without unpleasantness? Seriously. If life were what you think it should be, how would it be? I mean, do you really want it that way, actually? Oh, boy, be careful. Because I suspect that there maybe are three, or I'd say three ways that we live. One way, people take three different routes. There are three different ways to exist. And the most common way is to exist by the myth. Now, myths have nothing to do with Greek myths. The myth that could be called basic folk knowledge. Like, for example, there is a myth that says, evil will be uncovered eventually. Well, people live by this. Or they say, there are millions of myths of that type that say, I'm not very wealthy, but the people who are wealthy are happy. Happier than I am. Or, and you can take the other side, I am happy, but the wealthy people aren't. So I'm happy not being wealthy. Millions of myths, all kinds of myths. A man will work in an organization like where they sell sweet potatoes, and he believes because he has to, because it's a myth, and a myth is what he lives by, that sweet potatoes are important. He has to believe it. If he didn't, somehow his life would suddenly collapse. He also has to believe that he is connected with an organization that turns out better sweet potatoes than anybody. He has to believe it. And then, on the other hand, he has to believe a lot of things. For example, and one of the great myths, of course, is the myth of love, which is a real troublesome one. And It's like trying to find, you know, who was it? It was Diogenes that was looking for an honest man. I would say that Diogenes would have more success finding an honest man than he would have finding a happy man. A happy person. A truly happy person. Well, now, do you know anyone who is happy? Oh, already I can just see all the clean-limbed young ladies running for the phone to call up and say they're happy in these shrill, angry voices. Tell that man I'm happy! Wow, down it goes. Now, the other way you can choose to live, or it's not really a choice. You just pick it up, you know, you just sort of do it. The other way you can choose to live is by the absurd. Now, people who are bugged by the absurd, who are in a sense conscious of the absurdities in life, generally, because they are not capable of anything else, retreat from them. And so these are the people you will see who will bury themselves in the file department at BBDO, or let's say the file department at even some, let's say, the Widget Bolt Nut Company. And they cut out from their ken everything else that has to do with anything remotely connected with the outside world. You will never hear these people talk about Khrushchev. You will never hear these people talk about moonshots. You will never hear these people talk about how deep is the ocean. You will never hear these people ever once discuss a tornado that roared across Iowa. These people look at television and sleep. They have rejected life because of the absurdity or the impenetrability of it. And yet, they rarely are aware that they have. And so they will write you little letters that will say, and it was wonderful to get that type, they'll say, well, Mr. Shepherd, in these days, who wants gloomy things? Well, gloomy things mean truthful things. What is a gloomy thing is a truthful thing. What is a gloomy thing? I was trying, you know, it's fascinating. I don't know whether you're interested in this wild little psychological surmise that was made recently by a very interesting psychological researcher. And this is not an American type who is more interested in selling Wrigley gum and Dad's old-fashioned root beer. This is a man who is interested in what is happening. Why are we the way we are? His whole thesis was based on the fact that before every major war, there is a major and an all-encompassing dance fad that cuts through all levels of society. By the way, has it ever occurred to you that most of these people who are digging the twist have absolutely no realization of the fact that what they're doing is rock and roll and pure rock and roll? I wonder if they know that. I wonder if Peggy Fitzgerald knows that she's a rock and roller. She isn't a twister, she's a rock and roller. Remember, the name means nothing. And the other day I heard John or somebody giving one of these polite little announcements of coming attractions that are going on in all these little neighborhood events, and he was saying the ladies of the Presbyterian Bake a Pie a Week Club are meeting in the church basement next Monday night for a twist party. The admission is free. There will be a collection taken for the Abyssinian Library Fund. Now, remember, next Sunday, or no, it's a Monday night, the ladies of the Bake a Pie a Week Club of the Presbyterian Church will have their twist party. I wonder if those chicks know they're digging rock and roll. See, it's a matter of semantics. You know, it's interesting how we tag things. That I imagine in that very same pulpit, the minister has inveighed against rock and roll. Yes. You can't accept that term. Well, this is part of the myth. You see where the mythical angle comes in. Now, the people who are hung up with the absurd. Now, the absurd, of course, is a difficult position to be in, to understand or to feel or to know about the absurd. A very difficult problem there. Now, then there's a third way. And this way of existence is the least followed and the most difficult of all to understand. And that is the following of a logical path, which going back to the original Latin derivation of logic, has to do with developing a structure, literally developing a structure that is based on a few recognizable and established premises, like I am here. This is a recognizable and almost established premise. One philosopher said that when anybody ever attempts to talk about the mythos, the myth, by which a large percentage of the population exists, he will almost invariably be called a double talker, a kook, a crank, and possibly even insane, and certainly dangerous. Well, now the last one is true, because once the myths come tumbling down, be careful. Then you have to start a whole new situation. And so, you know, speaking about myths, there's a myth. One of the most probably prevalent myths is that people love the sea. People say they love it. In fact, I'll bet I can get 2,500 calls in the next 5 minutes if I say everybody who's listening who loves the sea, call me. Well, I remember a magnificent essay on that subject. I think, yes, it was in Moby Dick. Melville was talking about the actual fact that men not only do not love the sea, but the sea is one of the few things that we can truly fear, because the sea is totally and completely engulfing and enigmatic. And in addition to that, it is always waiting. It never relaxes and is truly unpredictable. No matter how scientific your tests become, the sea is there. And yet the myth that you love the sea continually moves around you. It's the myth that man does not love war. This is another great myth by which we live, that man is a logical, rational creature who does not like war and is led into war by insidious, cynical people. This is a great myth, one of the greatest myths. And it's a myth by which both sides live. This is a myth by which the Russians are living and a myth by which we are living, too. Of course, the cynical, rotten people always being the other side, invariably. It's a fascinating myth. Well, the other day, there's this little thing came out in the paper, and it was from San Francisco. And it is a wildly funny little item, and I read it to you. It's from the Associated Press. It's about, again, touching on the myth. Jeffrey M. Fletcher, craggy-faced captain of the British luxury liner Andes, has a confession to make about his 46 years at sea. "I hate it," he told astonished reporters yesterday after the 27,000-ton vessel docked on its first visit to San Francisco. Why were they astonished? Because he said the truth. That's why. They were astonished because they, like everyone else, are part of the myth. "I hate it. I'm afraid of it," he continued calmly, holding a cup of tea in one hand and his pipe in the other. "You should see me at sea. You should see me at sea, especially in rough weather. I know what the sea can do." Captain Fletcher, a bluff English sea dog with a sparse thatch of gray hair and an engaging smile, received the press in his cabin aboard the flagship of the British Royal Mail. He disclosed that this is his last voyage before his retirement, when the Andes returns to Southampton on its round-the-world cruise. He was asked, and this is a great answer. Listen, doesn't this describe what happens to almost all of us in any profession we get into? He was asked, this is the most truthful interview I've read in years. He was asked, well then, Captain, why did you go to sea in the first place? "Well, it was sort of a family tradition, actually. I needed the dough. I went to sea at 15, and I'm 60 now. I've been too cowardly to change." "Would you send your son to sea?" "I happen to be a bachelor, thank God," replied Captain Fletcher. "Actually, the sea's not so bad when the sun is shining. But when the weather turns bad, I don't like it a bit. Oh, I don't go around trembling, of course. I wouldn't do, you know. I don't tremble, actually, but... You know, I actually don't like it. End of interview. Speaking of myths, this is WOR AM and FM New York.
Well, that indeed is a myth, because you're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And now back to Gene Shepherd from 1962.
And we'll be here until... I can't... Man was only joking. What man? How does he know that? Oh, the World Telegram will not admit that he was saying the truth. They have to pretend that he's joking. Oh, yeah? The World Telegram has to prove its case to me other than the other way around. Believe me. You tell the truth and everyone has to say, oh, he's only kidding. You see, that's what happens. And I'm just a little trick you learn in life. The more truthful you become, the better you can get by with it. Because, one, nobody believes it when they hear it. And two, when they do hear it and believe it, they have to then make it sound like, oh, he's just kidding. Or, he's a kook. Or, what a fatty, he's a nut. Take him out. Now, whether or not you can argue the truth of what the man said is totally beyond the point. Everyone has to make it into a joke. You're kidding there. And that's why. Now, World Telegram, in its own little stumbling way, has hit on one of the great facts of humor. This is one of the reasons why Voltaire, when you read him, always sounds like he's just joking around. You know, he's saying funny little things. And Jonathan Swift, well, there's a Weenanims and all those Wahoos and Yahoos and all these kids, Gulliver and that. Just funnies, little funnies. And Lewis Carroll, all of them, funnies. All kinds of little funnies. Like you know, the funnies. And the poet has learned this many, many centuries ago, you know? That the deeper you dig, the more you can become truthful. And as long as they don't listen carefully. The human races all live where time and space is. Their nature uniformly base is. The Nordic races hop around in continual metastasis, leaving hideous industrial traces. The Mongol races have flat faces and live in most extensive places. The Hamitic races play in jazz bands with wild grimaces and wear purple shoelaces. The Mediterranean races have many graces and like to fill their lives with embraces. The Semitic races divide their time between the oasis and the widest of wide open spaces. The Celtic races drink whiskey by the dozen cases. Each man can hold as much as his own weight displaces. The Alpine races live on top or halfway up or at the bases of mountains where the air is vilely cold but braces. The Coptic races walk in processions at unseemly paces carrying enormous maces. The Carib races inhabit upturned carapaces eating seaweed, mussel shell, and uncooked daces. The Balkan races live roughly northwest of the place where Thrace is. Their conduct, a perpetual disgrace, is. The human races all live where time and space is. Their nature, uniformly base, is. Walk along, and you know it's again a matter of perception. Time to write a letter. It's a matter of perception. It's a matter of wanting to perceive or wanting not to. I think that almost all of us, if we really want to pull it out, have so many secret fears, so many secret, not only really fears, but secret shadows that kind of walk along with us. not behind us or around us or behind us or in back of us or in front of us, but sort of walk in tandem with us. In tandem, in tandem. And the feeling of a sort of universal dread is probably the most common of feelings. Whether we live by the myth or whether we live by the absurd or whether we live by the logique, and which, incidentally, is the most dangerous of all ways to live. Because the logique itself, you see, can be probably, unfortunately, the most colossal myth of all, you know? And so, I remember, you know, you have to relate back to history. Everybody has a little collection in his mind, in his memory, of first days. Do you know what I mean by first days? Like, let's say, the first day you were in high school. Or the first day you worked at your job. Or the first day you were in the army. Or the first day that you seemed to understand more than was really good for you. And there is a point where that begins to bother you. I don't know how many people out of 1,000 are ever troubled by this problem, but I'm sure it's more than most would ever admit. You know, speaking of first days, and I suspect that these first days are the most important of days. For example, if you go to a foreign country, your first day in a foreign city is going to be the most valuable day you will spend there. And for good reason. Because you are suddenly seeing, you are seeing with new, fresh eyes, things which you will never notice again. And since you will never notice them again, you will never, ever get to understand them. And so first days are extremely important. The first day you met someone who became a real part of your life, the first day, the really first time you knew this person, really. Those things are always floating around like a million little corks on the surface of our mind. And sometimes they're floating way back off there in shadow, in darkness, where you can't see them. I remember, speaking of first days, I suppose the most vivid first day that I have in my mind is the first day I ever worked in a steel mill. You know, again, this is a matter of perception and myth and reality, dream, and the logique. What does a steel mill seem to you to be? If I say to you steel mill, what do you think of in your mind? How do you see it? Do you think that you've even approached it? Do you think you've even scratched the surface of a steel mill? Well, let me tell you about the first day, and remember this. I lived within a mile and a half of most of my adolescent and childhood life, within a mile and a half of the greatest steel mills in America. So logically, I should know about steel mills, right? Logically, since most of the people who lived in the neighborhood worked in steel mills, the steel mill should not come as a surprise to me. Well, let me tell you about that first day. I remember this so vividly that it's as though it was some kind of a lithograph. Even better than that, a steel engraving hanging in this long corridor of my room, this room of the mind, with lights properly placed so they can be seen clearly. And I hardly ever think of it. I never look at it. It's like a picture that's in your house that you never look at. It's always there, you know? You walk in and out of the room, and there's this thing hanging. And you never look at it. And once in a while, you look at it and suddenly you say, yeah, Aristotle, contemplating a home of Buster. Yeah, there he is. You know? And it suddenly hits you again and again and again. And maybe one day you get so tired of this picture, you throw it out. But you never can really throw it out because it's always somehow hanging in your memory. That first day. Let me tell you about the first day. The first day in the steel mill. I was working in what they call the mail department. Now, this is not the mail department like here at the Lever House or at the 666 building or BBDNO or WOR. Oh, no, let me tell you that this is like being a mailman in a wild, fantastic, surrealistic city beyond all your conception. And it's a job that is that runs. You run constantly, and you're never in offices. You're running between great trains, and screaming, howling cranes, and falling pieces of metal, and screaming, moving, swirling sparks constantly. And you run and run and run, and you run until you can't run anymore. And then they say, go home, come back, and start running tomorrow. But I remember the first day. You see, because the steel mill is built out on the lake. You see, it's built on what they call made land. Do you know what made land is? This is land that's filled. The land moves out on a kind of slag base and foundation. This is made. It's like an animal, you see, that builds its own shell as it goes, you know? You know what I mean? That the ground that the steel mill is on is made out of the waste of the steel mill. It's perpetual motion. They just keep dumping it in the lake, and every so often they say, Charlie, we got 3 more acres now, for crying out loud, sticking out there. And they roll it down with a roller, and they build another mill on it. Eventually, I suspect the steel mill will stretch all the way to northern Canada, like a giant peninsula, all the way up the lake, and finally it'll work its way down Lake Ontario, and eventually could very well dock off the battery here, like a big snake going all the way up the St. Lawrence. I'm not kidding you. That's the way it is, and eventually it's going to be one big mill. And you get that feeling, you know, when you're working in it, like you're working in a cancer. You just don't know which. It's going bigger and bigger, and it's always being built, never being torn down, being built. Well, I'm a kid, remember. And I'm 16. I go down and I get my working permit. And this is a very exciting moment, you see. And I'm going to work, and school has just gotten out. And I have, like they say out in the steel mill, you got to have a drag. Well, everybody had to have a drag. By the way, is there anybody out there who does honestly have a drag? You know? They say, you know, is anybody out there who's really got a drag? Or is that a Midwestern expression again? You never heard the expression? Huh? Pull. No. Pull has to do with City Hall. No, seriously. That's a very different thing. We used to use that expression, oh, he's got pull down City Hall. No, we said, oh, boy, that guy's got a drag somewhere. That really means that, you know, you really got something going in the mill, you know, that there's an important guy, you know. Well, it's a funny thing. I, being an amateur radio operator, it was funny. I was on the air. I'm this little feckless youth, and I'm on 160 meters. And so I find one night that I'm sitting there talking to the superintendent of the rolling mill. Actually, it was just the superintendent of the roll shop. I mean, this is like talking to God out there. No, you have no idea how important this is. And I suddenly began to sweat. Because, really, it's like a little actor somewhere finds himself on the telephone with Daryl Zanuck. Oh, you know, you just don't expect to do this. And I'm sitting there, I'm talking, hi, Gil, how are you, boy? How about, you know, you're coming in here, so-and-so, blah, 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 a pair of 2A5s in the final here, Class B modulation. Yeah, I'm using a double extended ZEP with 600-ohm feed. Yeah, blah, blah. What do you do, Gil? I'm going to Hammond High. I'd like to know what you do over there. Okay, Gil, come on in. Gil comes back and he says, I'm the foreman of the rolling mill in Inland Steel. I'm out in a sweat like that. Well, I don't know how to get around to it, you know. So I say, yeah, well, that's a very interesting job you must have there, Mr. Gil, that's a very interesting job you got there. Hey, steel mill, huh? By George, you know, it's a coincidence, Gil. You know, there's nothing I would wanted to work in more than the steel mill. Strangely enough, you know, and I've always been interested in rolls. And, you know, oddly enough, I'm getting out of school next week. And say, Gil, I wonder if, you know, I don't want to put you in any trouble, but, well, anyway, to make a long story short, this poor, friendly, kindly man called me, and I went down to his home. He called, you know, he said, come on over some night, and he lived about 3 miles away, and gee, I was in the superintendent's home, and here was this feckless youth, and he said, well, he said, look, son, he said, and by the way, this was when jobs were not easy to get, and he says, look, son, you take this tomorrow morning, take this to the clock house, the number one clock house. Well, of course, this was a name that was so familiar to me. You know, it's like, say, take it to the MGM main gate. Say this to a bit actor in Hollywood. He knows about this. It's a famous thing. He says, take this to the number one clock house, and you show this to the man who's inside the little office just as you get in, and he will send you down to the place where you'll be talked to. And he said, I'll call him, and it'll be all set. Well, I'll tell you, that night I couldn't sleep. Oh, boy. I mean, I was sweating. I told my mom, I says, I got a job in the mill. She says, you're going to work in the mill? Of course, immediately, you know, mothers, the mill is this monster over here. And once in a while, you hear this big booming sound and sirens going and ambulances and all, you know, the whole bit. Immediately, mothers suspect that the ocean is going to swallow you up, and that's it, you know, and spit you out, nothing but the core and seeds and stuff. Well, anyway, oh, no, I'm going to, don't worry about me, Ma. So that morning, and I forgot to mention that he told me that I should get to the clock house about 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning. Oh, well, that's the mill. It's like the sea. I mean, the mill is like the sea and like the Great Plains. You don't sleep, you know. The crops are taken in early. So I go down there, and I got this paper. And boy, I'll tell you, I'll never forget it. I drive this little car I had. I had this little V8. I park it in the great big parking lot. Millions of cars where the mill was. And the sun was just coming up. You know, it was just getting bright, just getting light. And there's a strange chill around the steel mill. I cannot explain this. Do you know the chill that exists around totally inhuman things like crypts? Have you ever been inside of a pyramid? You haven't. Have you ever been inside of a great temple of some kind made of stone? Well, there is a chill, a strange, unearthly, inhuman chill. Well, I parked my car, and I'm wearing this T-shirt because back home it was warm, you know. It's summertime. It's June. And I get out of the car, and I walk through the parking lot, and this chill is beginning to reach out and get me. It's funny. I'm cold. The first time, you know, cold, and it's not cold like that there. And it's beginning to get chilly. Well, I get on the main pathway, which is a big concrete area way that leads to the number one clock house. And there are thousands of men walking towards me and walking with me. And this was the first peculiar, strange premonition, intimation I had that life isn't exactly the way it seems to be. Not exactly. Now, I do not know what it is. I've spent my life since trying to figure out just what it is. But it isn't what it seems to be. Because here were all these men. They were all walking. And they were walking fast, going towards the mill. And there were great crowds of them coming back. And they had a kind of dead look on their faces, which I cannot describe except to say that it was the kind of deadness that is... Well, it's deadness that is alive. A dead quality of a kind of, how can I say it, except to say that it's like an automobile or a machine that looks like it's moving fast, but it's got a burnt-out clutch. And it stands in the garage, beautifully streamlined and leaning forward. But it's not going to go. And there is a quality of deadness about a car in a garage. And yet, it looks alive. Does this mean anything? And these men were all walking, and they were all wearing lumberjacks, and they had hats on with buttons and stuff. And there I am jostling there with my cotton T-shirt on, and I'm getting cold. Now, I don't know whether I was getting cold because of the mill or because of this aura that is emanated from this strange place. Well, I finally got into the clock house, and thousands of guys are going through. The clock house is just that. It's the place where you punch in. And remember, this steel mill employed something like 41,000 men. Divided by three, and that's the number of men that went through that clock house three times a day. You see, there were three shifts. And so this enormous push is going through, and I walk up to the man who was in the little desk there. And somehow, my idea of work and working in the mill was completely different from this. I gave him my sheet of paper, which Mr. whatever his name was, had written down something. Call so-and-so, call number so-and-so, check on this kid, or whatever it was he wrote. And the guy didn't say a word to me. He just looked down, okay, picked up the phone, he dialed something. He says, Mr. So-and-so, blah, blah. Yeah. Okay. He hangs up. He says, all right, kid, get on the bus. And he says, go down to, tell him you want to get off at the number one stores. One of the guys will tell you where the number one stores is. I said, number one stores, you know? And suddenly it was becoming very real. And up to this point, working in the steel mill had been an idea. Now, you see what I mean about the myth and the reality? It had been an idea. Suddenly he says, get off at number one stores. Well, I had an idea. Stores. What is it? Stores. You know, stores. I could see places where guys bought chewing tobacco, you know, this kind of thing, and ice cream cones and stuff. Well, I get into this bus, and there was the bus, and it was a long, flat, strange conveyance where men sat all hock to hock. It was a bus that looked like it was 200 feet long, and it was made out of a black, strange, rough, welded sheet metal. And the windows were wide open. Well, no windows at all, just big squares cut out of the sheet metal. And suddenly, again, I was faced with the reality of everything is there's no nicety. You know what I mean? And we're sitting on this long metal seat. And on the other side are these guys all sitting in long metal things, and everyone is just sort of just looking ahead, carrying lunch buckets, and the sun is coming up over the lake. And remember, it's June. I have just gotten out of school. Do you know what spring vacation, summer vacation is? It was no time now. There was absolutely no season. It was nothing. I was in a foreign country, not only a foreign country, a foreign world. And I'm sitting, and we go, the bus. You can't hear anything. It's made of sheet metal. Have you ever ridden in a sheet metal bus with big, flat, solid rubber tires? No air in them, and riding over what they call a slag road. A slag road is a road that's made out of big chunks of iron slag packed down deep. And I'm aware around me, as I look out through this window, no longer is the steel mill a thing that you see on the horizon. It's no longer even a thing that can be recognized, you see, because you can recognize things on the horizon. You can recognize the moon from here. On the surface of the moon, you won't be able to. You can recognize problems in Katanga from here. But in Katanga, you can't. I can assure you of that. You can recognize what should be done by the administration here. But when you're sitting at a big oak table with the foreign ministers from Nairobi, you can't. And so I'm sitting in this bus, and it's going... And I see outside of these windows, I don't want to look eager, you know. That's the worst thing when you get into a terrible foreign country or a strange world, is to let everyone know that you're not a native. And so I'm sitting, but I'm looking out casually, you know. And I see these great buildings on either side, so close that you could reach out and brush them with your hands. Big square cutouts in the buildings. And I could see enormous ingots, boom, boom, back and forth, sparks. And it sounded like, to the ear which was not trained, it sounded like there was nothing but a continual scream cutting the air. A great, great scream of all the machinery, everything all together. And I'm sitting. Oh, I'm sitting, and I said to the guy next to me, say, you know where number one stores is? Number one stores? You want that, kid? I said, number one stores, I want to get. I don't know where they are. And he turns, and somebody sitting across from me says, number one store, to tell. Hey, Jerry, number one store, isn't that down there by the number three? Down by the number three AC down there. Hey, kid, get off by number three AC. You're closer there. Well, I didn't know whether I don't know where number three AC is. So I sat for a couple of minutes, and I just sat. And finally we got to a place where a lot of men got off. And I looked out. I thought I'd see something that says number three AC. Nothing, just great black buildings, smoke and steam. And right next to me, right out, you could reach out. Have you ever been 3 inches from the side of a steam engine? Steam came into the bus. Oh, I'm sitting, you know, I'm really worried now. I don't know what I'm getting into. And finally, I thought, well, I'll have to get off. So I got off with all these men. And the bus continued to go with half of the men off into the distance. And there I am. Well, there was an office into which maybe 25 guys went. And so I get in, I walk in the office, and there's a man with a guard uniform. And I said, I'm looking for the number one stores. Number one stores? Kid, that's another mile and a half down there. He says, it's past the 14-inch mill. What are you doing here? I says, well, how do you get there? Well, the bus is gone, kid. Just go on and walk down there past the 14-inch mill. You'll see, it's just right past the 14-inch mill. Ask for Hennessy. Past the 14-inch mill, ask for Hennessy. Well, I went walking down this road, and this road was not a road like you think of roads for cars. It was a road for what they call hot metal cars. Great Zeppelins filled with molten steel came moving down, and I could feel the heat from perhaps 200 or 300 yards away, and I'm hiding, cowering next to this building. And I kept walking and walking and walking, and sure enough, believe it or not, there was a sign that said 14-inch merchant mill. 14-inch merchant mill shipping dock. I'm getting there. So I walk up to the dock there where these guys are all sitting there. A couple of them have got big air hammers strung over their back. And I says, any of you men know where Hennessy is? Hennessy? Who? Hennessy? Bob Hennessy and the coal strip? I said, no, Hennessy in the stores. Hennessy. Hey, Chuck, do you know Hennessy in the stores? Never heard of him, kid. Well, where are the stores? Oh, they're down just around the next turn. You go right past the AC shop. You'll see the AC shop, and there's the stores there. Well, I made the turn, and there's the AC shop, and finally there was a little sign over the doorway. It says, do not enter stores unless you have a pass from your foreman. I had no pass. So I go up to the door. I figure they're going to let me in. I said to the fellow, I have to see Mr. Hennessy in the stores. Where's your pass, kid? Well, to finally get it down to the basic point, I finally arrived in the stores. And I'm sitting there, and here's a man comes out. He said, I'm going to fit you with safety shoes, kid. I see you got a note from Columbus. You got to get to work. The stores where they give you safety shoes and goggles. I said, well, what am I going to do? I don't know. That's none of my business, kid, huh? You're working for Columbus over there. You're working for Galavis over in stationary shipping. I have no... What the note says, don't come and ask me about that. That's not my problem, kid. You get safety shoes and goggles. And I walked out of the stores with a big pair of safety shoes that weighed 40 pounds each on a pair of goggles. And the sound rose and rose and rose and rose. It was screaming and hollering around me. I had nowhere to go, no place to go. I had no point of reference. And I went into a doorway where there was a telephone. I picked up the telephone, and I instinctively dialed zero, and I got this voice on the phone. It was the operator, the plant operator. I said, I want to talk to Mr. Columbus, please. Mr. Columbus. He says, yes, Mr. Columbus, who is the superintendent of the rolling shop. Oh, yes, Mr. Columbus, of course, sir. She thought I was a big man. I get Mr. Columbus. Say, hi, Gil. Hey, Gil, this is W9QWN. I'm over here in the 2AC, Gil. Please come and get me. Well, 20 minutes later, I'm in the stationary shipping department, and that was only the beginning. That day, I learned something very important. I haven't discovered yet what it is.
This is WOR.
No, it's WBAI in New York. And that was Gene Shepherd. From February the 15th of 1962. And I suppose next week, why not? We'll hear the show from February 19th, 1962. From the same tape. From a secret source. Actually, no, it's not that secret. What does it say here? From Palo Alto Microsystems. Gene Shepherd tapes are provided not-for-profit production of Palo Alto Microsystems. So there you go. So we thank you, Palo Alto. And we'll have more next week. And I've been Max Schmid. Next week, we'll be back exploring the popular music of the mid-1960s for the first 90 minutes of the show, and then close out with another episode of Vic and Sade and Gene Shepherd. I'll also be back here Sunday night at 7:30 for the Golden Age of Radio, the last show before the big fun drive begins. So stand by, and we'll figure out what the schedules are going to be for those programs. And don't forget the Friends of Old Time Radio Convention coming up the 19th to the 22nd of this month out at the Newark Holiday Inn North. That's what I'm driving towards at this point, but time to go. So I will see you next week or Sunday night. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for a wake-up call, which will follow after a few important announcements.